From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! Israel declares Yasser Arafat an enemy and attacks his headquarters in Ramallah, just hours after the Arab nations unanimously offer to normalize relations with Israel for the first time. We hope to go to Ramallah. The army will incinerate deadly nerve gas weapons in a metropolitan area of Alabama, but civilians aren't to worry. The U.S. government will buy them gas masks. And as temperatures escalate worldwide, scientists warn the Antarctic ice shelves may continue to collapse. We'll speak to one of the last scientists to visit the ice shelf that collapsed last week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel has formally declared Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat an enemy and invaded his headquarters in Ramallah. Troops, tanks, and helicopters moved in this morning, killed several Palestinians, and began shelling Arafat's headquarters. The invasion comes shortly after the Arab world unanimously offered Israel peace and recognition for the first time. The offer came at the Arab summit in Beirut and specified that Israel would withdraw from all the Arab lands it occupied in the 1967 war and recognize a Palestinian state with its capital in East Jerusalem. In response to the historic declaration, Arafat announced he was prepared for an immediate ceasefire. But Israel denounced the offer and announced it's calling up 20,000 reservists to free regular forces for an operation in the occupied territories that could last a long time. Meanwhile, a female suicide bomber detonated explosives at the entrance to a Jerusalem supermarket today, killing herself and injuring about 20. Earlier, a Palestinian gunman killed four Israelis on Thursday after infiltrating a Jewish settlement near the West Bank city of Nablus. Arab League also engineered an unprecedented reconciliation between Iraq and Kuwait. Iraq agreed to recognize Kuwait as an independent state and not to invade again. And in return for this support, Arab leaders vowed that any U.S. military attack on Iraq would be considered an attack against all Arab states. Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia publicly embraced and kissed Iraq's representatives. The New York Times reports, quote, "The message from the Saudis is clear. They coordinated an unprecedented Arab peace initiative toward Israel. On the very day, they also pushed through a surprise Kuwaiti-Iraqi reconciliation, suggesting that if the former problem could be solved, the Iraqi issue could too." We go right now to Ramallah, where Mustafa Barghouti is standing by. He's president of the Palestinian Medical Relief Committee. Ramallah right now, which is under siege, with hundreds of Israeli tanks moved in into the compound of Yasser Arafat. Dr. Barghouti, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Hundreds of tanks have moved into Ramallah. And what is the situation of Yasser Arafat's compound?
He's surrounded by tanks, and they are attacking his office all the time. And I think there is a very serious threat that he will be killed. I think Sharon wants to kill him and wants to kill all the Palestinian leaders. And he's making him a complete prisoner. And as Nelson Mandela said, only free men can negotiate. And Mr. Sharon does not want negotiations. That's why he's making Mr. Arafat and all of us prisoners of his tanks. He is reconstituting the old military occupation, which has been the cause of all violence here. And by doing that, he's hurting and harming his own people and us. I think he is facilitating and consolidating the occupation, which is the cancer that has been eating the lives of both people. And in my opinion, he's a war criminal that unfortunately has been allowed to continue his war crimes that he started in Sabra and Shatila in 1982.
And the situation for the other residents of Ramallah right now?
The situation is absolutely terrible. The whole population is under 24-hour curfew, which means nobody can leave their house for any reason, day and night. Anybody who dares to get out of the home will be shot at and killed. And many people who are injured are not receiving medical treatment because the Israeli tanks prevent access to medical care. At night, it's impossible to move. A woman died today because she bled for 3.5 hours to death. No ambulance could reach her. We sent 4 ambulances, and each one was shot at by the Israeli army tanks. It's a terrible situation, and it's going on. And on top of that, Israel has closed down all TV stations or radio stations, and they are also shooting a journalist. One TV crew was shot at, and a man was hit in the face with an Israeli bullet. I think they're trying to establish a blackout so that the world would not know what's happening. And what's happening actually is that Sharon is really crucifying the Palestinian people one more time.
Who of the Palestinians have died in Ramallah in the last day?
We've got 4 people dead and 25 people injured. One of the men killed was a mentally disabled man who did not understand what the tanks were doing there, and they shot him and killed him. This woman was killed while she was driving with her husband and child, and they were shot at, and her husband received 3 bullets. She received many bullets, and the neighbors could drag the husband in a house. They couldn't reach her. She was a bit far, and that's why she bled to death after bleeding for 3.5 hours. And 2 other men were killed in Mr. Fat's compound while trying to defend him. So this is, and 25 more people have been injured, mostly civilians.
We also have word today that it's the second time a Palestinian female suicide bomber moved in, this time to a Jerusalem supermarket. She blew up herself and injured 20 others. Your response to that?
This is a very strong sign of strong the frustration is on the side of the Palestinian people. This woman was totally frustrated, and I'm sure, and I don't agree with what she did. I think it's terrible to attack civilians anywhere, even if you're killing yourself in the process. But the world must ask the question, why a young woman would reach that level of desperation to commit such an act? And I think the reason is occupation. The reason is that we've been deprived from our liberty, from our freedom, from dignity. We've been oppressed and suppressed by a military occupation. We've been subjected to the worst kind of apartheid that has been, that as many delegations who visited us from South Africa said, is worse than the worst time of South African racism. Let me tell you, on average, Palestinians make $800 per capita per year, while Israelis make $1,000. We share the same market. We're obliged by Israelis to share the same market. We are obliged to be using no more than 50 cubic meters of our own water, while Israeli settlers use 1,450 cubic meters. It's a total discrimination in every sense of the word. You can't have your own business. You cannot open your private business without Israeli permissions. Israel is controlling our lives. And, you know, it's 35 years of occupation, which has become the longest occupation in modern history. And there comes a time in people's life when they just cannot take it anymore. And this time has come to Palestine. We want to be free from occupation. We want to be dignified. We want to be treated equally with respect. We want to be like you, people who can live normally and who can educate their children in a normal way and who can live in a normal way and who can have health care and just live a respectful life.
We're also joined on the phone, in addition to Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, by Hueda Aras, who is a coordinator for International Solidarity Movement, living in Ramallah right now. I was looking at a picture in the New York Times of José Bové, the well-known anti-corporate globalization activist, farmer in the south of France. He is right now in Ramallah with hundreds of other international activists. Hueda Aras, can you describe why?
Well, these internationals came under the banner of the Grassroots International Protection for Palestinians, which is a Palestinian coalition of grassroots organizations reaching out to international civilians. The International Solidarity Movement is also a growing movement of civilians, which is under the banner of this grassroots movement. And we're reaching out to the civilians of the world because our respective governments have failed to act, have failed to take any kind of decisive action to provide protection for Palestinians from brutal Israeli aggression, not only occupation forcing Israel to comply with the international law and UN resolutions and end its occupation of Palestine. But on top of that, they're using brutal aggression against the Palestinians to maintain an occupation, with the international community, respective governments, the UN, refusing to act. The people are fed up and saying, we need to do something, and the people are mobilizing. And so we had hundreds of internationals arriving in the region yesterday to the occupied Palestinian territories. We've also had a couple of hundred internationals blocked and beaten down when they were trying to protest and enter to be in solidarity with Palestinians. But we do have a good number here that are witness to the carnage that is happening right now and that are on the phones with their consulates and with media and with their civilians in their home countries and saying, we see what's happening. The world must stand up. The world must cry out now.
Hoveydad, speaking to us from Ramallah. This program, this organization, International Solidarity Movement, all over the occupied territories and all of the cities, and what overall is the response to by the Israeli government to these groups? I understand hundreds alone have come in from Italy now into Ramallah.
The Italians actually, only small groups were able to come in. The rest were physically restrained and even beaten down when trying to come in. So the Italians right now are being restrained and held in Jerusalem, but we have many other delegations in here. Right now the Israelis are firing very indiscriminately, very dangerous to be anywhere out on the streets. What we are trying to do and what we have done is put internationals into ambulances. I don't know if Dr. Mustafa spoke to you about that, as he is monitoring and working with the Palestinian medical relief committees. But we're putting internationals in ambulances to help get ambulances through areas where the Israeli army is preventing them from getting to the wounded. Not only are they firing, injuring, and killing, but then they're preventing the ambulances, the Red Crescent Society, from getting to these people and tending to them.
Dr. Barghouti, what does it mean to you to have people from the United States, from Italy, from places all over the world in your city right now? Dr. Barghouti, are you still with us? No, he's gone. Well, finally, let me put the question to Hoveydad Aras, the response of the residents of Ramallah to so many people from around the world.
Yesterday, we were received very warmly when the group that were the first group that was able to get in, of about 100 plus, gathered in the center of Ramallah. They were received very warmly, and the people definitely, as I'm walking down the street, I could hear yesterday people asking and inquiring about the safety and the well-being, and have these internationals arrived. And it's a sense of awe, but definitely gratefulness that there are people that are willing to stand up for justice and that we are not being left alone. However, the Palestinian people are very much worried for the safety of the internationals that are trying to do as much as they can to change the situation, to cry out, to get into the ambulances, as are the Palestinian and brave workers, the medical relief workers. Everyone's worried for the safety of the whole area and the whole region, because this area is flooded now with Israeli tanks. And as I'm speaking to you, I hear them firing. It's a very dangerous situation, but I can tell you that the Palestinian people are very grateful for international solidarity, because otherwise we feel like no one is listening and we've been left alone.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Hoveydad Aras, coordinator for International Solidarity Movement, living in Ramallah on the West Bank, where the Israeli troops have moved in, hundreds of tanks. And right now they are laying siege to the city block-long compound of Yasser Arafat, who Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has called an enemy. And here in this country, the FBI has arrested a man who drove his truck into the front of the Islamic Center of Tallahassee just 30 minutes before evening prayers on Monday. According to police reports, the driver told officers he could have blown up the mosque if he had put propane tanks on the front of his truck. He also said he tried to join the military in order to kill Muslims. The Associated Press reported that a Bible wrapped in a blue cloth was on the front seat of the driver's truck. Authorities say the incident is being treated as a hate crime. Born Under Punches, Talking Heads here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. The U.S. Army is moving ahead with a plan to incinerate deadly nerve agents in a metropolitan area in Alabama. But people shouldn't worry about their safety. The federal government announced on Wednesday it'll spend some $7 million for gas masks and training for thousands of civilians who live near the Army incinerator. Bunkers in Anniston, Alabama, hold over 2,000 tons of rockets, artillery shells, landmines, and bulk containers of chemical weapons. Some of the obsolete munitions date back to World War II and contain mustard, sarin, and VX gases. The weapons must be destroyed under terms of an international chemical weapons treaty. But this will be the first time the U.S. Army has attempted to incinerate the weapons in a heavily populated area. The Alabama governor's office filed a lawsuit to block opening of the chemical weapons incinerator several months ago, but the office relented when the government said it would pay for gas masks and training. We first go to Craig Williams, director of the Chemical Weapons Group Working Group. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. Can you first lay out what this story is about? The U.S. military is going to burn nerve agents in the atmosphere?
Unfortunately, that's true. First, I'd like to make a small correction. The governor's lawsuit is still engaged in Alabama. What he's done is he has withdrawn the injunctive request from the federal court, but there are still a number of issues contained in the lawsuit that have not been addressed in the emergency preparedness area, so that lawsuit is still alive. The Army plans to burn some of the most lethal chemicals on the planet in their incinerator in Anniston, Alabama, in the midst of 75,000 people. The incineration approach has been resisted at all of the sites in the United States, but at four of them, they continue to pursue incineration, Anniston being one of those sites. There are three sites that are now going to use low-temperature, low-pressure, non-emissive neutralization technologies, but Anniston, unfortunately, is not one of them. There's one site where there's still a decision to be made as to which technology is going to be used, and it appears as though that one's going to go non-combustion as well. These incinerators have a history of releasing live agent out of the stack during upset conditions and unanticipated conditions. We can document 16 times when that's happened. They also emit a host of toxic material on a chronic basis, even when they're operating correctly. And as your listeners may be familiar, the town of Alabama is the most heavily polluted PCB location that's ever been discovered. They also have high contamination levels of lead, mercury, and other substances, all of which are going to be emitted from this smokestack 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for somewhere in the neighborhood of 9 to 10 years. And we just find that there's absolutely no justification to use a technology that they know is going to emit this stuff, they know has a history of agent releases, when there are safer, contained, and controlled approaches to destroy this material.
We also have Mike Abrams on the line with us, a spokesperson for the Anniston Army Depot's incinerator facility. Can you respond to what Craig Williams has described that sounds truly like a danger to the population if you were to incinerate these nerve agents?
Well,
I didn't hear your Craig's comment.
Well, he's talking about the dangers of the incineration of these nerve agents and the number of times that they actually have escaped into the atmosphere.
Nerve agent itself is dangerous. There is no doubt about that. The facility is a safe, a proven safe way to destroy those dangerous agents.
But what about the population?
It doesn't. The population is best served by the Anniston Chemical Agent Disposal Facility. We have the facts through safe disposal operations on Johnston Island in the Pacific Ocean and at the facility in Utah. We have safely destroyed 16,088,000 pounds of chemical agent in those two locations, and no one, none of the workers, none of the people who might live nearby have been hurt. This population is at risk because the weapons are stored here since 1961. Thank God, and it is Good Friday, thank God that no one has been hurt. We don't know that we can have a perfect safety record forever. We know that we have a perfect safety record destroying chemical agents, and we will continue that record at Anniston when we start incinerating chemical rockets with nerve agent GB probably this September.
Craig Williams of the Chemical Weapons Working Group.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that people have been exposed. Workers have been exposed at both Johnson Island and Tooele. The Johnson Island facility has had five live agent releases. The two incinerators in Utah, the Camdis and Tokdeff facility, have collectively had 11 live agent releases. There have been so many modifications made to the facility in Anniston that it is frankly not a proven technology. The incineration technology, generally speaking, is proven. It has proven that it emits toxic material. It is proven that it cannot contain these agents during unexpected, unanticipated conditions. And it is proven that it takes 3 to 4 times longer to process these weapons than they originally predicted. Finally, the United States Army has neutralized, in a 4-year period, over 10,000 tons of nerve and blister agents. In the 12-year period, they've only incinerated 7.5 million tons. So, 1,000 tons, rather. So, the history of neutralization is extensive. It's a controlled process. And the history of incineration is actually counter to advocating that that kind of facility operate in a populated area.
Let us go to a break, and then we're going to get a response to your claims. We've been talking to Craig Williams, who's director of the Chemical Weapons Working Group. We'll get a response from Mike Abrams of the Anniston Army Depot's incinerator facility. And when we come back, we'll be joined by some others as well from the Alabama Governor's Office, as well as families concerned about nerve gas incineration. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
It starts high in the mountains of the north, crystal clear and icy trickles forth, with just a few floating wrappers of chewing gum dropped by some hikers to warn of things to come. At Glens Falls, 5,000 on his hands, work at the consolidated paper plant.
Casey Neal, Old Father Hudson Sailing Down Dirty Stream by Pete Seeger, here on Democracy Now! listener nourished radio. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the burning of nerve agents in Anniston, Alabama. We are talking to several guests, joined by a spokesperson for the Army Depot facility. He is Mike Webb Abrams. We are also joined by Craig Williams, director of the Chemical Weapons Working Group. Mike Abrams, would you like to respond to Craig Williams?
Once again, Craig has taken little bits of information and is trying to make a mountain out of those little bits, those little molehills bits of information. The fact of the matter is that we have not heard anyone. The fact of the matter is that with the exception of May 8th in the year 2000, when a minuscule amount of agent was detected in an exhaust stack that did not present a danger to anything outside 10 feet of that exhaust stack, a situation that cannot happen in Anniston, the facility on Johnson Island, the facility in Utah, has had a superb safety record in safely destroying chemical agent. All of the chemical agent on Johnson Island is now gone. No one was hurt destroying those chemical weapons by chemical agent. So far, since
does anyone live there?
Yes, there are 1,300 people who live there. It is a remote location. Everyone who lives on the island has some sort of job there. But we should not belittle the importance of every single employee on the facility. We do not take for granted the 120,000 people who are my neighbors who live in this area of northeast Alabama. Everyone who works at this site in Anniston is a member of this community. We have a strong commitment not only to protect our coworkers and ourselves, but the environment and our families and our neighbors. We are not doing something that presents, rather, a threat to this community. Rather, we are a solution. The stockpile presents a risk to this community. We have the key to safely disposing of that risk, and we expect to begin the new era of safe disposal this fall.
Rufus,
we have had safe storage, an era of safe storage since 1961.
Let me bring Rufus Kinney into the conversation of families concerned about nerve gas incineration. You live 17 miles from the incinerator. Can you describe your concerns?
Well, it would take a long time to describe all of my concerns, but first of all, I want to address something that Mike Abrams just said. He's assuming that constant emissions of dioxin, furans, PCBs, heavy metals, lead, mercury, acetone, benzene, vinyl chloride, trichloroethane, and literally hundreds if not thousands of other poisons day and night in constant low-level emissions is never going to hurt anybody's health. That is absolutely crazy. We have 75,000 people living directly downwind of this incinerator that are going to be exposed to these emissions constantly, day and night. Now, when people get cancer 5, 10, 15 years from now, and when they have, you know, when children have birth defects and when you have immune and respiratory system problems, the Army will have said, oh, well, we destroyed that stuff, you know. So, you know, it's crazy to assume that it's not going to have negative health effects when these are known poisons, virulent poisons, and nobody has any idea what the synergistic effects of these poisons will be. So even under the best of circumstances, we're going to be exposed to virulent poisons for years to come, including trace amounts of nerve agent. So Mike is, you know, he seems to assume that nobody's going to be exposed, but in fact the Army told us we could expect exposure, but no fatalities. And I said, when this was brought up at a county commission meeting a couple of years ago, I said, my God, what do you mean? We're going to be exposed, but nobody's going to die? What if my children are exposed but don't die? You know, how long are they going to suffer? And at what cost? And who's going to pay for it? And who can replace, you know, the health of a beautiful child? So Mike is making a crazy assumption here that nobody's going to have negative health effects. And another thing, out at Johnston Island and at Tooele, Utah, those are very small populations. This is a large city. And so to be exposed constantly to these emissions for 10 or 12 years is unconscionable. Not only that, But Mike failed to point out that President Bush just last month characterized the incineration program as ineffective, citing cost overruns and schedule slippages and safety concerns and poor planning. And so the president is a Republican, and he has said that the program is ineffective. The governor of Alabama is a Democrat, so this is a nonpartisan situation. I mean, high-level officials have characterized this program as a loser. And Mike also failed to point out that the parent company to Westinghouse Anniston is bankrupt. How can you trust a bankrupt corporation to do this job well? Also,
Mike Abrams, would you care to respond?
Once again, my neighbor is bringing in a number of things that have no relevance to this program. Westinghouse is the contractor for this site. It is a government-owned, a contractor-operated facility, and as the contractor-operator of this facility, they are insulated from the financial dealings of their corporate leadership. It is something totally and separate from what we are doing in Anniston. We are not, I don't know how many times we have to say it, we are not emitting toxins into the air constantly day in and day out. A scientist for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention noted that one pack of cigarettes smoked in 1 year's time does more to the environment than our facility is, could possibly do. We have the cleanest facility in the country, bar none. We are going to be burning chemical weapons about a quarter of the time that we are operational. The rest of the time, it is planned maintenance, planned changeover from one type of weapon to another.
Can I ask why? Can I just ask why are you giving out gas masks to the entire population then?
We are not giving out gas masks. That is a misnomer. I'm not sure where that thought came from, other than the governor and his staff, in concert with the Calhoun County Emergency Management Agency, our home county, and the state emergency management agency, believes that there is some value in having additional safety equipment. The Army, at the cost to our program, and we get harangued by people like Craig Williams for cost overruns, but this program is constantly having additional things to fund, such as the $40 million that has been transferred to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which now is working with the state to fund the protective masks that will be brought to Calhoun County in some fashion.
Well,
are still be worked out.
Let me bring that up.
Is not the Army issuing the masks. That is a Federal Emergency Management Agency program that is working with the state to provide some additional equipment.
So let me bring Ted Haspin to the conversation, legal assistant for Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. The Alabama governor has filed a lawsuit on behalf of the 35,000 people in eastern Alabama. And at least according to the Associated Press reports, at least 35,000 people in eastern Alabama could receive the protective hoods and training, these hoods that resemble gas masks. Ted Hasp, why?
Well, as has been stated, the protective hoods are an additional safety measure in case something terrible happens. We have a conflict here in that I think everybody believes that the best thing to do is to get rid of these agents. Nobody wants them in their backyard. The governor certainly does not want them in Anniston, Alabama anymore. On the other hand, you got to make sure that when you do get rid of them, you do so in the safest possible manner. The governor's lawsuit was designed to ensure maximum protection of the citizens. And one of those items that was decided upon in a series of meetings back in the fall of 2001, fall and winter, was the protective hoods. But again, our sincere hope and expectation is that nobody will ever have to use their protective hood.
and they're going to go to all people who live nearest the incinerator. Would that include you, Rufus Kinney?
Well, that's a good question. Once they update the toxicity of the nerve agent, they're likely to extend, and I think they will extend, the pink zone or the danger zone all the way to Jacksonville, because the outdated toxicity assessment of the nerve agent is based on battlefield soldiers, exposure of battlefield soldiers, and does not take into account elderly people, civilians, children, and so on. So we have a long, long ways to go to get maximum protection in place. By the way, I'd like to point out that these poisons coming out the smokestack during normal conditions, I was reading that off an Army document. So Mike Abrams is incorrect in saying that steam is coming out that smokestack. All kinds of poisons are going to come out. But as far as maximum protection is concerned, we have got to overpressurize every school in Calhoun County. We've got to overpressurize the hospitals. We've got to overpressurize the nursing homes. The daycare centers, nobody said a word about daycare centers. What about all the children in daycare centers? We have to have individual plans for the 3,900 special needs people in Calhoun County, people who are handicapped or live at home and have special needs. And what are we going to do about people coming into Anniston on daily business from other places? I think they should be able to have the right and be encouraged to pick up a gas mask at the Chamber of Commerce when they come into town. Now, Mike would say that this is being, overly, that we're too scared. But the fact is, I personally don't intend to do business in Anniston once that thing starts up. I'm going to start doing my shopping in Gadsden, and I'm going to demand a gas mask for myself, my wife, and children if we should ever have to go to Anniston.
Rufus Kinney, what about the alternative? I mean, I think all people want to ensure that chemical weapons are destroyed. Some of the obsolete munitions we're talking about date back to World War II, contain mustard, sarin, and VX gases. But what are the alternatives to doing it the way the Anniston solution has been laid out?
That's an excellent question, and Craig Williams touched on that earlier. Neutralization is a low-temperature, low-pressure process that can effectively eliminate the risk of this nerve agent and these weapons to this community much quicker and much more safely than incineration. In fact, they've already decided to neutralize the stockpile in Maryland on a fast track based on what happened in 9/11. And they're going to do it 3 years quicker than originally scheduled and at a savings of $200 million.
Now,
Mike's going to jump in and say that they only have bulk agent there, but we know that we can also do the rockets this way. We can disassemble them so they can't explode, neutralize the nerve agent, and then restore them. And that will be much quicker, much safer, and no poisons will come out of smokestack into the community, whereas incineration is high temperature, high pressure, and now they have this harebrained scheme that they're going to try in Alabama for the first time of chopping and dropping gelled rockets into the deactivation furnace. That sounds pretty technical, but basically their own original permit said that you have to have four separate waste streams for safe burning, so they built four incinerators. But now they're going to speed up the process, they're going to chop and drop gelled rockets into one waste stream, which goes directly against strict requirements of the original permit. They're making up the permit as they go along here in Anniston because they know that they think they can get away with it because the Alabama Department of Environmental Management rubber stamps whatever changes they make. And so this is hot, reckless, it's crazy, and it's an experimental form of burning right on top of 75,000 people. It's not acceptable, and we're not going to put up with it.
Ted Hasp of the governor's office, why did the governor sue to begin with to stop the beginning of the incineration of the nerve agents?
The reason the governor sued is essentially been a holdup on the money that was promised by the federal government to achieve maximum protection. Federal law requires during the incineration process that the residents be provided maximum protection. Undersecretary of Defense Pete Aldridge, convened a group back in the fall of 2001 based on the governor's demands to the federal government on a number of issues, some of which have already been discussed, including overpressurization, the protective hoods, and things of that nature. And on November 1st of 2001, the federal government agreed to provide approximately 40 million dollars, really $40.5 million, designed to go exclusively towards safety items. Unfortunately, that money was held up, and we have not yet received all of the money. It was supposed to have been, according to Secretary Aldridge's directive, provided to the state within 30 days. That would have actually provided state officials with significantly more time to prepare for the burn. Unfortunately, the delay has caused us a great concern, and by the middle of February, Governor filed suit because the time had just gone on too long, and it was time to ensure that we got the safety measures, so he filed the suit. We're hoping that, given the developments in the recent days, that we are on a course right now, but the governor is watching the situation very carefully, and if need be, we will go back to court.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Ted Hasp, who is the legal aide for Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, Rufus Kinney, families concerned about nerve gas incineration, teaches English at Jacksonville State University, Mike Abrams, spokesperson for the Anniston Army Depot's incinerator facility, we had on with us on the line Craig Williams, director of the Chemical Weapons Working Group. And we'll continue to follow this story in Anniston, Alabama, of the U.S. military burning the nerve gas agents that go back to World War II and the reaction of the community. Again, the U.S. government has agreed to give out hood-like gas masks to residents nearest the incinerator. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to switch gears. We understand we've just gotten in touch with the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui, who is federal prosecutors are seeking the death penalty against him if he is convicted of conspiring with the 19 hijackers to commit the September 11th attacks. He is in prison in the United States. This is a very significant story, and we hope to go right now to that just after this break. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department announced on Thursday it will seek the death penalty for Zacharias Moussaoui, the French citizen accused of being the 20th hijacker in the September 11th attacks. The trial will be held in Virginia this September. The French justice minister responded by saying France will refuse to provide evidence to support the charges against Moussaoui that carried the death penalty. The 33-year-old Frenchman of Moroccan descent who converted to Islam while living in London was in jail on immigration charges at the time of the attack. He is the only person so far to stand trial for the attack. So again, the French justice minister has responded by saying France will refuse to provide any evidence to support the charges against Moussaoui. Any charges, any evidence, if he does face the death penalty in the United States, as France is against the death penalty. We have on the line with us right now an exclusive interview. We're joined by Aisha Elwasi, who is the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui. She is in the south of France, and she will be translated by Sputnik Kalambi, who is a reporter for Free Speech Radio News. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Bonjour, madame, vous entendez? Je souhaite la bienvenue à Democracy Now! Oui.
Your reaction to the U.S. government's announcement that it will seek the death penalty against your son?
Alors, votre réaction à cette décision des autorités américaines de demander la pénalité de mort contre votre fils?
Eh bien, ma réaction, madame, c'est d'une mère qui, avec la tristesse et une angoisse que je n'ai rien à expliquer parce que ça ne s'explique pas.
And explain, it is, I have the normal, natural anguish and terror of a mother. Any mother should be able to understand. Continuez, madame.
Let me fill in our listeners. Prosecutors face the difficult task of arguing for the execution of a man who was sitting in a jail cell when the four planes were hijacked and crashed into the World Trade Center, Pentagon, and into a Pennsylvania field, killing more than 3,000 people. Legal experts say a judge or jury might balk at executing someone who did not participate in the actual event. Both sides and the judge in the case have been proceeding for months on the assumption that Zacharias Moussaoui case would involve the death penalty, but the court filing makes that certain. I want to ask Zacharias Moussaoui's mother, Aisha Elwasi, about your son. Can you tell us where he was born, where he went to school, how he ended up in the United States?
Madame Elwasi, est-ce que vous pouvez nous raconter un peu de votre fils? Où est-ce qu'il est né? Comment est-ce qu'il il a évolué? Comment il est devenu aux États-Unis?
Écoutez, madame, d'abord, je voulais vous dire quelque chose que ce qui concerne les Américains, parce que je voudrais les transmettre toutes mes condoléances et toutes mes douleurs de toutes ces familles qui ont perdu les leurs et qui ont perdu leur famille, ils en souffrent comme moi.
Un moment, s'il vous plaît. First, I would like to tell the American people, I would like to express my deepest condolences to all the families who lost loved ones after the attacks of September 11th. Continuez.
Et qu'est-ce qui concerne mon fils, madame, mon fils, il est né le 30 mai 1968. Et c'est un garçon qui a fait des études comme tout le monde, qui a été comme tout le monde. Je n'avais aucun problème à propos de ce qui concerne moi et lui.
My son was born on 30th May 1968. He was a very normal child. He did his studies like everybody else. I never had any problems with him at all. Oui.
Et qu'est-ce qui concerne dehors ou le racisme ou le ça c'est autre chose. Moi je ne sais rien du tout. Vous savez le racisme entre copains. Sale arabe ou sale négro ou de certaines choses que moi je ne peux pas rentrer dans le détail. Je sais que le racisme ça existe un peu partout.
I know that racism exists everywhere, and perhaps I think my son was also accused of being a dirty Arab and a dirty black. I don't know. Oui.
Mais c'est un garçon comme tout le monde qui a suivi une scolarité comme tout le monde. Et puis, quand il est arrivé à 13 ans, 14 ans, qu'il voulait faire un bac général, le lycée où il était, il trouve que ça suffit pour faire un BEP d'électricien parce que c'est un arabe, ça suffit pour lui.
And in fact, he was an ordinary boy like everybody else. He did his studies, and when he was 14, when he wanted to do his baccalaureate, the final high school exam like everybody else, he was told he should move towards the technical field because he was an Arab, and that he felt deeply. Oui.
Oui, après, il avait fait ce BEP d'électricien, et après, il a fait son bac, il a pris une BTS, il a fait enfin de tout jusqu'à il est parti. Il a quitté la maison, il avait 22 ans, et après, madame, elle est partie en Angleterre, et depuis, moi, je ne le suis pas, parce qu'à 22 ans, pour moi, c'est un homme, et il a fait sa vie comme il veut, et il me téléphonait de temps en temps, et c'est tout, qu'est-ce que je peux vous dire? Je ne peux pas vous dire qu'est-ce qu'il a fait exactement.
And then he continued his studies. He qualified as an electrician, and he left the country when he was 22, when he decided to go to England. And at that point, he would call me from time to time, but I can't tell you any more about what he was up to because he was old enough to lead his own life. Amy?
Yes. Go ahead.
He was in Angleterre, donc il a fait un doctorat commercial, il a fait une maîtrise, il a fait. Et moi, j'étais contente de voir qu'il arrive à faire quelque chose. Et quand il me téléphonait, moi, je lui demande comment il va et si tout va bien, si tout. Mais je ne peux pas dire qu'est-ce qu'il a fait ou il n'a pas fait, ça, j'en sais rien, parce qu'il était grand, il était c'est un homme. Alors,
yes. And when he went to England, he completed his higher studies, he got a master's, he got a PhD, and I was very happy that he was doing so well. But as far as the rest of his life, I cannot say because he was a man by then.
We're talking to Aisha Awafi, the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui, who has been charged. Well, federal prosecutors in this country will seek the death penalty for Zacharias Moussaoui if he is convicted of conspiring with the 19 hijackers to commit the September 11th attacks. He was actually in jail at the time of the attacks. Prosecutors also notified the U.S. District Court in Alexandria, Virginia, of their plans in a 9-page motion citing Moussaoui's lack of remorse and the impact of the attacks on the victims' families, the wounded survivors, the Pentagon, and the New York economy. Let me ask Aisha Awafi, Mr. Moussaoui's mother. When you learned about your son being in the United States?
Allô?
Oui, elle veut vous demander quand est-ce que vous saviez que votre fils était aux États-Unis?
C'est quand je l'ai vu. La DST, il m'avait téléphoné. Si je sais où il est, Zacharias, je dis je ne sais pas. Et après, je l'ai vu à la télé, c'est tout.
The French Secret Service called me to ask if I knew where my son was. I said I didn't know where he was, and then I saw him on the television.
Je voulais, s'il vous plaît, lui dire à cette personne
mm-hmm.
que Zacharias, il était en prison le 16 août, et l'attentat, elle était le 11 septembre. Et que quand j'attends qu'elle est responsable des attentats, ça m'a fait... j'arrive pas à accepter parce que elle peut pas, il peut pas être responsable des attentats parce qu'elle était en prison.
Ok, un instant, s'il vous plaît. Un instant, laissez-moi traduire.
Oui,
I just wanted to say that my son was in jail on the 16th of August 2001, and the terrorist attacks took place on September 11th. And when I heard that he was accused of being involved in that, I just could not accept it. He could not be responsible for September 11th since he was in jail at the time. Oui.
Et vous savez, si... c'est-à-dire mon fils il a fait quelque chose où il a des problèmes des relations avec une raison ou quelque chose c'est tout à fait normal qu'il paye pour qu'est-ce qu'il a fait, mais je ne veux pas qu'il le prenne pour un bouc émissaire parce
oui.
que les Américains ils souffrent et parce que les Américains ils sont malheureux qu'ils vont prendre la vie de mon fils. Pour ça ne soulage pas leur souffrance, ça ne les rend pas leur famille qui sont morts.
un instant, s'il vous plaît. Oui, un instant, s'il vous plaît. I just wanted to say that if my son were guilty of something, if he had actually done something, then he should be tried for those crimes and he should pay. That is normal. But I do not want my son to be the scapegoat because of the suffering experienced by thousands of Americans to find to pin the crime on my son when he is innocent of it. It will not bring their loved ones back. Justice needs to be done. My son should pay for what he's done, not for what he's not done.
For our listeners, I'm looking at a piece in Newsweek from a few months ago, although U.S. justice officials say the case against Zacharias Moussaoui is based on circumstantial evidence. Newsweek learned that federal officials do have intelligence linking Moussaoui to at least one of the September 11th hijackers, Hamza Al-Ghamdi, whose plane crashed into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. Foreign intelligence sources told the U.S. government Moussaoui and Al-Ghamdi were close associates and may have met in an Osama bin Laden guest house in Afghanistan, but prosecutors left that point out of the indictment for reasons that are unclear. Newsweek first reported lawyers for the Federal Bureau of Investigation turned down agents in Minneapolis who sought a special national security search warrant, which would allow them to open a computer to seize when they detained Moussaoui, who first came under suspicion while in a Minnesota flight school, after French intelligence divulged that Moussaoui was known to have, quote, radical Islamic beliefs and ties to bin Laden followers in Chechnya. The agents asked for the warrant. A few days after that warrant was denied, the attacks happened on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. What about that description? Let me put it to Moussaoui's mother, Aisha Al-Wafi, of your son having, quote, radical Islamic beliefs.
Qu'est-ce que vous en pensez de la description de votre fils qui était séculé par les autorités américaines comme quoi il avait des croyances radicales islamistes, qu'il était un fondamentaliste musulman, il avait des liens avec Ben Laden?
Écoutez, madame, moi, ça fait 4 ans que j'ai pas vu mon fils. Même pour moi, je n'ai pas de réponse à ces questions. Ça fait 4 ans que j'ai pas vu mon fils. Et ça fait 6 mois que j'ai reçu une lettre de lui en me disant « Maman, je n'ai rien fait. Tout ce qu'il me reproche, ce n'est pas vrai. Moi, je peux, il y a des choses que je peux répondre parce que je le sais, mais il y a des choses que je ne peux pas répondre parce que ça fait 4 ans que je ne l'ai pas vu. »
Ok, écoutez, un instant.
Je regrette de ne pas répondre à ces questions parce que je ne le sais pas moi-même.
Oui, I'm sorry I cannot answer in more detail to this question because it's been 4 years that I have seen my, that I haven't seen my son and I don't know what has happened over these last 4 years, but I can tell you that I got a letter from him 6 months ago in which he said, Mama, I'm innocent of all these crimes they're pinning on me. I didn't do anything. That's all I can say. This is what he told me.
Do you plan to visit your son in jail here in the United States?
Est-ce que vous comptez visiter votre fils en prison aux États-Unis?
Eh bien, vous savez que la dernière fois, je suis venue pour le voir, mais comme le FBI m'a imposé un agent qui doit enregistrer la conversation, en plus, il y avait une vitre entre lui et moi, et plus, il y avait un agent qui est là en train de regarder. Et je pense que vous devez comprendre que je suis une mère et je voulais seulement lui dire à mon fils que je l'aime et puis que je pense à lui et puis que mon cœur est emprisonné avec lui et que j'ai pas pu le voir parce que je voulais le voir mais c'était pas possible.
Oui,
je voudrais le voir, le toucher comme une mère qui touche son fils simplement. Mais ils m'ont trop posé des conditions et que les avocats ils m'ont dit faut pas l'accepter parce qu'ils ont pas le droit de
faire. Sputnik, we have just 15 seconds.
Yes, okay. No, I did. When I came to the States, I tried to see my son, but they imposed such conditions on me. There was an FBI agent the whole time. There was a glass between me and my son. Our conversations were being recorded, and I just couldn't. I couldn't meet him. All I wanted to do was to touch him, to tell him I loved him. I'm a mother. Can't you people should be able to understand what a mother feels? But they didn't allow me to see my son.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to continue this on Monday, a surprise interview that we got just during the program with Sputnik Kalambe and the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui, Aisha Al-Wafi. Thank you. This has been Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.